Hello, everyone, and welcome to Live CityLine Reel on Race. I'm going to introduce you to our panel today. We've got Dr. Shelley Tuchluk here from Los Angeles joining us. We have Dr. Ismael Traore here joining us from Vancouver. And Dr. Tuchluk, you told me right before we started broadcasting, this isn't your day job, talking about anti-racism work, but this is work that you have been very committed to for many, many years now. And Dr. Traore, you do work in anti-racism work at the University of British Columbia. Thanks to both of you for joining us today for this talk. We are tackling topics that make people very uncomfortable because we're talking about white privilege, we're talking about white fragility, and we're talking about allyship. And listen, we've got about 40 minutes to chat about these topics. They're big topics. We're not going to get through all of it, but we want to give you a good sense of what you might want to look for when you hear these terms come up in discourse these days. So I'm going to start with the easiest question. What is white privilege? There are so many people that are just waking up to this new terminology, and I'm going to ask you, Dr. Traore, to define it. How would you define white privilege?
Well, first of all, thank you, Tracy, for inviting myself and Dr. Tuchluk for a very timely, it's been timely conversation for decades now, but now we have new reasons to continue to have this conversation. The term white privilege gets a lot of people's back up. Ultimately, white privilege or race privilege is the opposite side of the coin of discrimination or racism. You can't have racism without privilege, right? So because in a sense, racial taxonomy or racial inequality is it's an issue of power. And so if some have more power than others, some have more resource than others, then others have less than those who have more. And so that is all that privilege is. It is not an accusation. It is not a concept that is weaponized for the purpose of making people feel guilty. It simply says that there are some groups of people, in this case, white folks, who have a certain leg up as a result of historical accumulation and of resources, historical stealing of resources in some cases, and historical advantages. And it plays out in the racial inequities that we see today. White privilege is not only the presence of that leg up, but it's also the absence of race-based barriers. And I'm being very specific here to say race-based barriers, because of course, life is complicated. We're not just one-dimensional, but we also have other identities like class, sexuality, gender. And based on these other identities, there are different forms of barriers. But as far as it concerns to white people, there is no race-based barrier.
Okay, so when I think of white privilege, I remember being introduced to Peggy McIntosh's Invisible Knapsack of Privilege when I was in university. And it's the first time I had thought about things like going to the store with my parents and not seeing any dolls that looked like me, or opening a textbook and not seeing my history reflected or anyone that looked like me reflected in history, or crossing the border and never thinking about how there may be a bit of a skirmish with the border guards because I'm with my Black father and my Black mother and my Black sister. And it was eye-opening. And I think what I hear a lot when I mention white privilege is people say, but I'm struggling. Like, I am a white person and I am living at the poverty line. I have health issues. Life has not been easy for me. And so if someone were to say that, how would you respond to that? And either of you can answer this. Dr. Tuchluk, do you want to answer this?
I'm happy to share. I am an educator. I teach people who are getting their teaching credentials, and I teach in a population that is very diverse. And while I don't teach this subject, I do bring up exactly what Dr. Traore just mentioned is, we have multiple social identifiers, and every one of them comes with either advantages or disadvantages based on how it's been that how each of those different identities have been treated within the society, which has been dominant, which has had power or not. And so the reason I do that is because that allows us to see all of us as fully complicated human people, where if I have class disadvantage, I don't have to take that out of the equation. That's still part of my life experience, but that doesn't take away the from the fact that I have race advantages. And so to try to just like offer that way in to the conversation, it's not a conversation only about race. And what happens in our society far, far too much is that we seem perfectly willing to talk about other advantages, but when we get to race, there's a lot of pushback against it. And so that's my way to make it a little bit more of a gentle opening for people, quite honestly.
Okay, we'll talk about that pushback in a moment, because I find that that's the thing that often stops conversations from getting anywhere because of that pushback. But I just to really drive the point home, are there any Dr. Traore examples you can give of white privilege? And this can be on the micro or the macro level or both.
I think when we look at social disparities, of racial disparities of any indicators, health, income, wealth, life expectancy, likelihood or unequal distribution of police brutality, of being incarcerated, those social indicators always show a racial disparity. And so those will be examples how on a macro context, race is tied to such things as health, wealth, income, and all the other stuff I mentioned. I mean, even the whole conversation about COVID-19 and how some racial groups, especially at least in the context of Canada, Black and Indigenous people are disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. That is also another example of discrimination. And on the other side, of privilege, because if you're a white person, it means you are not as impacted relative to the amount of people in your population than racialized people.
And Dr. Touchlock, do you want to weigh in there on the micro level, perhaps?
Sure. Sure. One of the things that's been really useful for me is learning that there's sort of four different levels of how bias and therefore power and bias end up playing out. The internalized, then the interpersonal, and then the institutional, and then the wider systemic. So on the very, very internal, I had the privilege of being raised in a way that allowed me not to have to think about race for many, many years. It is a privilege not to have been so racialized early on, although now I look at it as a disadvantage. It didn't allow me to gain the skills I needed, but at the time it fostered in me an expectation that I could go anywhere and have the assumption that I would be respected. I walk into a store and have the assumption that I will be well treated, not followed around, not accused of something, not treated as though I'm a criminal. When I go to an interview, I know that my racial background is not going to be the thing that impacts my ability to get that job. I'm more likely to face somebody who is in a power position, who looks like me and might be able to relate to me and see me as someone that they might be able to connect with a little bit better. So those are a lot of very subtle ways that I've experienced it in interpersonal situations. An important thing about privilege conversation for me has been that it's not like I wake up in the morning and say, oh, I'm going to go make use of my privilege now. Let me go cash in. That is not an intention that I have. And at the same time, there's nothing I can do to actually stop some of that from happening. Even if I go out into the world as someone who's intending to be anti-racist, I still receive the benefit of people giving me the benefit of the doubt a lot more often than people of color receive. So those are just a few pieces.
Okay, great examples there. Thank you. What good have you seen come out of those who acknowledge and accept their white privilege? Because you're right, you're not intentionally going out there and throwing it around, but it's happening. So once you become aware of it, what are the good things that can come out of that?
Well, you know, I think how I would answer that is to point people to the research and literature on the cost of racism to white people, which is very different from saying the impacts of racism, right? So there's a cost to racism, even to people who benefit from white privilege. And it could be very simple microscopic costs, such as not feeling, you know, having, you know, this white fragility or white guilt or white shame or anger, which are, or even more deeper psychological defense mechanisms, such as denial and rationalizing and limited or distorted empathy. All these make someone less of a well-rounded, holistic, and healthy human being. To become aware of one's privilege is to see oneself as existing within a society in which they then feel accountable for inequalities and inequities. To a lot of people, a lot of white scholars who have written autobiographies in developing white and a white anti-racist identity, they talk about that as if it's some sort of a process of redeeming oneself, a process of healing, a process of being more at ease in their bodies and with their identity. And so to me, though, you know, I that's what I would say. I would say white awareness of white privilege has a lot of socio-psychological benefits.
I want to talk about Dr. Tetchlaff. You have a TED Talk that is so good because I feel like it really describes the process that someone might go through and some actionable things that can happen at the end of that process when you actually start to understand the way you move through the world. And you said that at about 25 years old, someone said to you that that being white had shaped your life and your thinking. And what was your response to that?
I believe the technical term was hell no. I absolutely rejected the idea. I mean, I really did not, I did not see myself as somebody who had been shaped by race. I took it as an indication of that person not seeing me for who I was. I took it very badly. I was very defensive, and it took quite some time before it, now we call it white fragility. At the time, we just called it defensiveness. I know white fragility speaks to a lot more than just that. But what happened for me is that I had to go through an entire process of sort of unraveling what I knew to be true in the world. Because what my psychological experience was at the time was feeling that if I allowed this person to say that I was operating out of assumptions that were framed based on, and I was being challenged on both race and class at the time, that somehow my whole worldview was suspect. And quite frankly, I was afraid of what that was going to lead me toward. And it took me a protracted time period to learn how to navigate that conversation. I'm not really proud of how I behaved during that time at all. In fact, most of the work that I have done since then was to try to help people who have been in my position as a white person, not taught to think of myself as a white person, thinking of myself as an individual, somebody who attempted to be colorblind, thinking that that's what was going to make me good in the world on race. And I had had a very diverse upbringing. I had been a sprinter on a track team where I was one of the few white girls, you know, and so I had been sort of in mixed company and thought that I had had friends, you know, for years. So this was the first time I was told that actually you're bringing something to the situation that you're unaware of. And it was not until I was able to actually pull myself back and do some depersonalization to say, maybe two things can be true. Right. So maybe there's something of my world that may be true, but maybe there's also part of the world that I'm not aware of. And so if I sit and listen long enough, maybe I can hear the truth in what somebody else is saying. It was extremely uncomfortable and hard, but I have found that having developed that skill, it made everything else possible.
How do you do that, though? Because how do you go from that's just not my reality to, oh, maybe that can be my reality and their reality is different? Because that's the thing. You're having to convince yourself that everything you know is not true. Well, it is true, but it's a different truth than other people. So do you remember what it took to get to that point?
Yes. I remember, this speaks to the woman that forever changed my life. And it was a book. It was Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum and her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And that book helped me understand that white people have a racial identity process of which we are usually unaware. And we go through very, very late in life, oftentimes. And there was an article I read from her that basically, as an educator herself, she spoke of what she had experienced when she was teaching a lot of undergraduate white students. And she said, you know, there's three ways to be white that are kind of common in at least in the United States at this time. The dominant narrative is you can either be racist, you can be guilty, or you can be totally unconscious. Like, raise your hand if you want to be any of those three things. And who wants to be those three things? And then this was, you know, 20 plus years ago, but she was introducing the idea of the white ally. And I remember thinking, oh, I want to be that. Like, that sounds good. That's something I want to be. But then I started asking around. So what does it mean to be a white ally? And nobody in my life that was white had an answer. They had never heard of it before. To Dr. Beverly on the James point. And then I started asking a bunch of black folks I knew, do you know what it means to be a white ally? I said, absolutely. And they said, and I what is it? Tell me. I said, oh, it's a white anti-racist activist. And then I was afraid because that was not how I identified myself. And I say all of that to say it was that journey, that opening of understanding that there was something that was required of me to understand and acknowledge about how the world was operating. And this also came from her book. She spoke of the way that all of us are swimming in waters that are completely inundated and infused with racism. And understanding that the racism is in the waters that we are ingesting and that it's all around us all the time helped actually to take the sense of guilt and shame away from me, that I didn't create this. I didn't buy into this. I'm not consciously trying to enact racism. But because of just the social milieu that I'm in, of course, it's going to be part of my institutions. Of course, it's going to be part of the structures of society that I'm part of. Of course, it's going to have gotten into me. And it was actually being able to acknowledge that and a little bit of that depersonalization. This isn't all about me, but I'm a part of it. Wow, that means I get to do something about it. That's the part I get to play a role in, is who am I going to be in this? And who I'm going to be in this is someone who can hold two different realities. This idea of both and. Something can be true and there can be something else true. And that has changed everything for me from then on.
Okay, and that really does speak to what Dr. Traore was just saying about like coming out on the other side and feeling like good and fulfilled and whole, because you're the kind of white person you want to be in that category of allyship, right? Let's work towards working together. So I know, Dr. Traore, you've done a lot of work with allyship. You've studied it a lot. And I'm wondering if you can break down, we see a lot of performative allyship right now because the issue is out there, and folks that had no idea or had the privilege of having no idea these race issues existed are now seeing it for the first time. And I feel that there are people feeling the pressure to do something or at least look like they're doing something. And maybe you could start by just defining the difference between performative allyship and real allyship.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that Shelley actually brings up Dr. Beverly Tatum, because I was also going to mention an analogy that she uses in that book to talk about what racism is and also what allyship is. And so she uses what is called a conveyor belt analogy. Right? So she mentions that, yeah, imagine you're on a walkway, and the direction of that walkway, because racism is so ingrained in society, that the flow of the walkway is naturally leading towards a racialized structure, a society in which there are racial disparities as a result of racism. Now, the person who is racist is actively moving in the same direction of this walkway. This is somebody who has overtly or sometimes subtly identified with the idea of white hegemony, that they are intentionally preserving and perpetuating the flow of the walkway in this analogy, racism. Now, the person who is a non-racist is a person who's just standing on the walkway. They're not actively going in the same direction, but just by standing, they are going to the same direction as the person who are walking in the same direction of the walkway. And I, you know, the vast majority of white people are in this category of non-racists because they tend to define racism as an intentional act. So if one is not moving in the direction of the walkway, then obviously I am not racist, right? Unfortunately, the lack of moving, or in slogan words that is quite common today, silence is complicity, inaction is action, because there are no neutral stances that one can take when you're existing in a society that is inherently racialized. Now, the anti-racist, or what some decide to call the white ally, is obviously moving in the opposite direction of the walkway, but they have to move faster or with a lot of force, with a lot of commitment, in contrast to the flow of the walkway that is going in one direction. So that's a beautiful analogy. But to be able to walk the opposite way of the structure of racism, of the current, you have to know, you have to be aware of, well, what does racism look like? What are its various manifestations? And very importantly as well, disassociating the idea that racism is an emotion, right? So racism can occur, or in the words that I prefer to use, one can participate and perpetuate racial disparities in different social indicators, even if they're not intending to, even if they don't have an emotion of, yes, today I am going to perpetuate or maybe even increase racial disparities in who has COVID-19, right? You don't have to have that intention. In fact, the vast majority of people don't have that intention. But because the walkway is so structured, and that if you're not walking the opposite way, in other words, if you're not aware of what racism is and the various ways it manifests, if you're not being intentional in closing those racial disparities, then you are accountable to whichever way race relation goes, whether it leads to more racial disparities or it closes the racial disparity gaps.
That is such a good analogy. And we all know that when you're on the moving sidewalk and you need to go the other direction, because my kids sometimes think that's fun to do, like go the opposite direction on the S, it's hard. So I want to talk about the fact that when you look at performative allyship, you put up a post, you bought a book, you haven't risked anything. It's not that difficult. Maybe a little bit. You've risked a little bit. Maybe most of your followers or most of the people in your community don't ever want to hear you talk about anything race related. So you've maybe ruffled a few feathers, but allyship means that you're actually you've got skin in the game, and it's uncomfortable. It's not an easy thing to do, to walk the other way on the moving sidewalk.
Absolutely. You know, performative allyship is often done with an underlying desire to be seen as good, as innocent. And, you know, kind of what Shelley was talking about as in one of her phases as she developed more higher understanding of whiteness and anti-racism. Performative anti-racism is often driven by that sense of, I'm doing it because I'm aware that I actually either benefit from whiteness or that racism exists, and somehow I feel guilty about it, and therefore I want to be seen as good. I want to be seen as innocent. I want to not be seen like these very right-wing extremist groups. And that has a lot of pitfalls, because if your intention to do a work of dismantling racial disparities is driven by how one is going to be perceived, accepted, then you don't really have skin in the game in a long-term sense, because it means that if somebody, for example, calls you in or calls you out or says, listen, I don't like the way that you're going about doing your allyship, or you know what, I actually think that what you just did perpetuates racism, then that person will feel that their sense of identity, their desire to be good, desire to be innocent, is suddenly under threat. And when your sense of identity is under threat, then it's not surprising, or commonly what happens for a lot of people is that they get defensive and want to backpedal, or want to argue, or want to explain why they did what they did, and they focus more on intention instead of impact. So performative allyship is driven by this need to be good, as opposed to somebody who has a teeth in a game, who's really committed to anti-racism, who does this as a result of wanting to, because A, they're aware that, you know, racism is bad for me as well, even though I'm not a direct victim of it. It is bad for society. It is bad for me. It is bad for my community. It is bad for my family to be living in a society in which there are racial disparities. But second of all, they're doing it not for themselves, or what can also happen in performative allyship is that your anti-racism or your allyship is done because you know somebody who is Black or you know somebody who is racialized. So you're doing it just for that one person to support them. But somebody who has developed higher consciousness of anti-racism, do it for society, do it for a large group of people that includes them. So it tends to lead to more commitment and also an openness to wanting to learn, because they have arrived at an understanding that it's not about being good, and therefore I will make mistakes along the way, but these mistakes do not stop me from still being committed.
Okay, that's great. And I want to talk about the mistakes, and I want to talk about the importance, Dr. Touchluck, of having some kind of a community that can help absorb some of those mistakes. You've chosen to walk the other way on the moving sidewalk, and that's not an easy choice to make. So what do you do in terms of having a community that can hold you accountable and you can be accountable to help you with that process?
Well, number one, I got very, very fortunate. In 2003, I was in the world trying to figure myself out. I had been called in, one would say, into racial awareness, and I had struggled already for a number of years. But I did really want to do, I wanted to figure out what did this mean for me. I was on a quest to figure out how to live responsibly in the world as a white person. And enough people knew that I was on that journey that I got an email about a group that was about to start of white anti-racist people. And I thought, I want to know what that is. That was not a thing back then. This was not something that there was a lot of. And so I went to check it out. And that was 16 and a half years ago. And that was the first meeting of what would become what is called now Aware LA. It's the Alliance of White Anti-Racists Everywhere. It's our Los Angeles organization. It's all volunteer. And it took me about 3 months to realize I'm not alone. There are other people who are struggling just like me. There are people who are confused like me. There are people who are trying things and failing miserable like me. Sometimes we came together and just, you know, sometimes it was about just naming, we don't know what to do. And some of us in the room would be more ahead than another and give feedback. It took about 6 months before I admitted that I hadn't told anybody where I was disappearing to once a month on a Saturday afternoon, because I didn't know how to talk about it. I didn't know what to say. I was both embarrassed and conflicted. And we ended up spending a couple of months drafting what's currently online, awarela.org. And we've got this sheet called Why a White Space. And we actually articulated, here are the reasons why we as white people need to work together to develop an anti-racist identity and practice. And some of those reasons include that people of color should not be expected to be our educators on this. We need to be able to take up you know, the emotional burden and the work of doing that. But it is challenging to unlearn a lifetime's worth of assumptions. There is a dominant narrative that is based in individualism and very hard to break a habit of going into. So if racism is systemic, how is it that we're going to break through all of that on a regular basis? And that's something that's, I think, happening right now is a lot of people are waking up. A lot of people are becoming motivated to look around, and that's all important. But becoming anti-racist in one's psychology is not just flipping a switch. It's not just deciding, oh, okay, there's systemic racism and it's all about the police now. Good. I understand everything now. It's not that way, because every additional conversation that we as white people have with our extended white family or our extended white coworkers or friends who aren't on this journey already very far advanced will always come with a yeah, but what about? The media will continue to give us a very white framed individualistic narrative that we need to keep processing and figuring out. So that is a space where we can process it together, holding ourselves accountable for not giving up when we get critiqued, sometimes very strongly. And then also pressed to like, and so now what? What's the next step on your journey? It's not just about our own learning. It's also about how we extend the learning into taking action. And sometimes that action might be about policy institutional shifts. Sometimes it might be about taking that extra step forward in conversation that we were afraid to before.
We're getting some questions in from our viewers, and I know, Dr. Traore, you have to leave very soon, but I just want to throw one out there. How can I best be an ally and support to my Black partner? What may I miss or inadvertently be insensitive to? I want to honor and support my partner the best I can. So I think it's a question about opening the door to allyship. What is the first thing to do?
There are many first things to do, and so I will just provide a variety of things that one can do. Number one, in the literature, we talk about exploration, ethnic identity, racial identity, identity exploration, which is to learn about your identity and the history that it's connected to. So what does it mean to be white today? What does it mean to have white privilege? What does it mean? What are the different modes and stages or types of being white? The more you have that knowledge, the more it allows one to be reflexive and to be self-aware. I think that should be a fundamental quality to have, which is self-awareness. The second thing is, I think, yes, it's important to frame allyship and anti-racism as supporting my partner or supporting my racialized colleagues, but make sure that that doesn't lead to some form of white savior complex, where your supporting comes with a lot of strings attached, where your allyship is conditional on other people not inconveniencing you as you go about your everyday life. And unfortunately, there's a lot of white allies who do that. They're like, okay, well, because you don't want me to be part of this people of color only group, I feel, you know, I feel rejected, I feel discriminated against, I'm not going to help you, et cetera, et cetera. No, so don't fall into white savior complex forms of allyship. Another thing is listen. Listening is very, very important. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, we tend to be in a society where we have a lot of workshops on how to speak and get your voice heard. We're all about speaking, and there's not enough workshops on how to listen and how to not only listen while you are trying to come up with an answer. You know, a lot of people's listening is based on just like really waiting for somebody to finish so they can respond back. But it's like, how do you actually actively listen? So I would say make space to listen to racialized people, to your partner, about what their experiences are. It's very, very, very important. And also learn how to take leadership, right? So a lot of white people do not have racialized people in their surroundings that have been mentors for them, that have been, you know, whether it be professors, in other words, that had a type of authority where they could follow the lead and get used to following the lead of a racialized person. And so it's very important to follow the lead of racialized people, but also without putting them on a pedestal, also without assuming that simply because somebody is racialized and have experience of racism that inherently it means that they are very well versed in critical race theory or anti-racism theory. But whatever the case, it's still very important to listen, to acknowledge.
Thank you so much to both of you. That was an excellent session. And I hope that that self-awareness and that introspection happens before the pushback happens, because it's an important part of the process to just stop for a second and think without tone policing, without, taking over completely, which is the white saviorism, without getting defensive, which is the fragility. It's really important, I think, to listen. So such great tips. I'm going to contact both of you after this to get the resources you mentioned, because you mentioned some great resources that we want to put online for people to read, because this is, of course, just the beginning of the conversation. And I want to thank our viewers for coming with us on this journey every week on our YouTube channel. Subscribe to the channel. We will be back next Tuesday at 3 p.m. We are dissecting microaggressions. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be a great conversation. It always is. A huge thank you to Dr. Shelley Touchlug and Dr. Ishmael Traore. Thank you, both of you, for being part of this conversation and for advancing our education.